Hello, and welcome to my podcast. This is an audio version of my videos, available to make listening to my stuff in the background easier than YouTube makes it. But since my videos are primarily made for YouTube, there may be occasional references to visual materials. If you'd like this podcast ad-free, you can join us on Patreon at patreon.com/vicerhino. Please enjoy. Hello, and welcome to my channel. Vice Rhino here. Today, I'm looking at a video from a channel called Switch Youth, and it's supposed to be giving us three reasons to believe that Christianity is true. This is a half-hour talk with a lot of filler material, so I will be doing a lot of skipping around, but there is a link to the original video in the description, so you can feel free to go and watch for yourself to make sure that I'm not doing any dishonest editing. Let's go!
All throughout my teenage years, I had the same opinion of God that I did of Santa Claus, right? I had the idea, the belief in my mind that God and Santa Claus were both made up by people in positions of authority to try to get people to behave in a certain way.
While I do not hold to the idea that the concept of God was originally invented specifically to control people, it is undeniable that religion has been used as a tool for controlling people several times throughout history, and arguably still is being used to that end today. And really, I think the arguably in that sentence is doing a lot of heavy lifting. It seems pretty obvious to me that it is, with the current regression on women's rights happening in the US with a religious basis, combined with politicians pandering to the religious voting blocks in order to gain or keep power, and are using religion as the excuse for restricting rights, all while trying to claim that their country is the freest country in the world. And of course, that is a very American-centric view. As much as I think it's obviously being used to control people in the United States, I feel like even if you disagree with me on that point, it pretty obviously is definitely being used to control people in the theocratic nations that do still exist today. But we are talking specifically about Christianity here, so we can ignore most of those other countries, though again an argument could be made that any time there has been a Christian theocracy, the religion was used to control the people to about the same degree as the other religions are being used to in other theocracies today. All this to say that, yes, religion is often used for the purposes of controlling and subduing the general population, even if God as a concept was not originally invented specifically for that reason. Also, it is in a part that I'm skipping, but since this organization is called Switch Youth, it is worth pointing out that the chyron they have for this pastor lists his title as Switch Pastor. Someone really needs to teach apologists how to look things up on Urban Dictionary before deciding on names and titles, because that, to me, says that this pastor is someone who can be either a sub or a dom during sex play. Which is fine, you'll get no judgment from me, but most Christian organizations generally like to keep their sexual fetishes a secret, often because when people find out about them it turns out that they were illegal. So I guess kudos to this guy for having a legal one?
And so all throughout my teenage years, I found myself in this place where not only did I not believe that God was real, I didn't even believe that Christianity was good.
Yeah, that's about the point where I'm at. The world would be a better place without Christianity. There would be fewer organizations that use their tax status to hide money. There wouldn't be a problem with certain services like adoption only being provided by Christian organizations in some areas, leading to discrimination in who is allowed to adopt and who is not, with atheists and LGBTQ couples regularly being turned down. There wouldn't be entire networks of organizations ready to protect people who are abusing their authority. There wouldn't be a loophole where people are allowed to call themselves a counselor because they are a Christian counselor, and thereby bypass any educational requirements that are in place for them to be an actual counselor, resulting in counseling services that end up doing more harm than good. There wouldn't be such widespread and vocal opposition to LGBTQ rights. And I could keep going. The good that Christian organizations do can be done, often more efficiently, without the religious elements. And the bad things that they do are often directly enabled by the religious elements.
And then there was a moment where, honestly, everything changed for me. It started because I was introduced to a group of Christians who loved me unconditionally.
Try coming out as gay or trans and see just how unconditional that love is. And for the record, with this being a trendy church aimed at young people, there was a possibility that it was one of the more liberal churches that is accepting of LGBTQ people. But no, while they haven't done any videos specifically on that, they do make it clear elsewhere that marriage is only for one man and one woman, and that homosexuality is something that will stop you from inheriting the kingdom of God.
God's plan was there to every person to have one God with one man and one woman, one marriage, one sex partner. And some of you are saying, well, what does do wrong mean in this? Like, people who do wrong will not. They go on and clarify. Look at it. Those who indulge in sexual sins, who worship idols, commit adultery, male prostitutes, practice homosexuality.
So, yeah, that clip was from this same church, lest you think I was being too hard on them for just assuming that they're against LGBTQ rights.
And this overwhelming sense of purpose that helped them see every day as a day that mattered.
That's interesting. Because here's the thing. If I knew for a fact that I would be admitted to an afterlife where I have an infinite number of days, and that all of the days in this afterlife would be perfect, and obviously better than the days I have in this life, then I would feel rather the opposite. It's not these days that matter, it's the ones that come after you die. Whereas an atheist who believes that once you die, that's it, you're done, every day matters that much more. $1 is more valuable to someone who has nothing than it is to a multimillionaire. Scarcity increases value. By having eternal life, that cheapens this life.
We've got to figure out, is Christianity even true, right? Because if it's not, then bye, right? Like, if Christianity isn't true, then what are we doing?
I don't think this was intentional, but he did just highlight the downside to Pascal's wager that most apologists prefer to ignore. Living a Christian life comes with costs. And I don't just mean the lack of hedonism that a lot of Christians will immediately think of, though that is certainly valid. I mean, after all, if God isn't real, then why should I live my life in a way that, according to all the research that's been done on the topic, ends up with worse outcomes across the board? But even putting all that aside, we are now left spending a significant chunk of our lives sitting in a building being preached at when we could be doing something more important, like spending quality time with our families. Actually, no, that could be considered hedonism as well. I want to do fun things. It's fun to interact with the people that I love. It's not fun to be forced to sit through a boring sermon with them just beside me. So even if you put all that under the category of hedonism and say that, like, oh, well, that's just you wanting to sin or whatever, what about a scenario where one of my kids ends up not being straight or cis? Without Christianity, nothing in my relationship with my kid needs to change if that happens. I still love them and support them and encourage them to be happy, healthy, and safe. But if I were a Christian, that's now a moral quandary. The Bible says that homosexuals will not inherit the kingdom of God. What am I to do? Just allow my child to end up in hell? No, gotta change their sexuality in a process that amounts to torturing them. Sorry, but I'm not like the Christian God. If I have a choice where one of the options involves torturing my child and another involves loving them unconditionally and supporting them, I'm gonna go the unconditional love and support route.
And really what this is gonna be is just like very introductory, right? I'm not gonna go into all of the details because these different arguments and all the evidence associated with them like fill books upon books upon books.
You know, that's another thing that's always bothered me about apologetics. Like, what other person who is supposedly alive today would expect people to believe that they exist based solely on a bunch of books that rely on logical argumentation rather than just popping out and saying hi? Or even just doing something detectable? If my kids have kids one day, I won't remain aloof from them, relying on my kids to tell them about me and then hope that they find books or blog posts or articles that have been written that use logical arguments to prove that I exist. No, I will be right there with them from the beginning, holding them, changing their diapers, all while complaining that I thought I was done with this, talking to them, reading them stories, playing with them, because those are the kinds of things you do with someone when you want to have a relationship with them. And then that leads us to the question of what about all these people who didn't believe before all these philosophers and apologists came along to formulate their logical arguments? Since nobody had thought of the cosmological argument before then, can the non-believers from before that time be forgiven on the grounds that they were not given sufficient evidence, even if you consider logical arguments to be evidence? Of course, at its core, that's kind of the same problem you have with Christianity as a whole anyway. God knew where everything would end up, so why would he not just make Adam and Eve's first kid the savior who you would need to believe in to get into heaven? Then the whole world could just have one religion, just like Jesus prayed that it would.
The first reason is this, that something came from nothing.
No, it didn't. At least, that's not the scientific consensus, at least not with the definition of nothing favored by apologists. And it's funny, because often they can be found pointing this out themselves. After explaining one of these several models that could account for the origin of the universe, they will point out that, in that model, the universe didn't come from nothing, it came from something. To which I say, yes, that's the point. Science does not say that the universe came from nothing, so pretending like this argument is backed up by science is disingenuous at best.
Question for you. Do magicians really pull rabbits out of hats? Is it magic? Right, when you think about it, I hope your answer is no, that they do not magically pull rabbits out of hats. And the reason why I'm asking you these questions is because there's just something in us that knows that things don't just randomly pop into existence out of nothing.
I'm actually really happy that you used the magician and bunny example for that, because that is literally the position that you are advocating for. I think that if I actually believed that a magician was conjuring a rabbit out of literal nothing, I wouldn't say that it materialized randomly. It was created by the magician. If it were random, he wouldn't get a rabbit every time he did it, and yet without fail, it's a rabbit. So that's a pretty good analogy for God creating the universe. And given that all the scientific models for the origin of the universe begin with something rather than nothing, even the one that we think of when we say something from nothing is talking about a quantum vacuum rather than an actual nothing that apologists favor, but given that all of these models start with something, then what we know of the origin of the universe at this time points away from it having come into existence out of nothing, and so also points away from the God hypothesis, at least in the context of the cosmological argument.
But what's so interesting is that both the scientific and the biblical account claims that the universe began to exist.
Began to exist, yes. But one of us has it beginning to exist in the same way as a rabbit magically popping out of nothing to fill a hat. And guess what? It ain't science that says that one. You seemed to think earlier that the rabbit coming out of the hat was very obviously not a plausible thing to happen, so I'm curious how you're going to get this back around to actually supporting your position.
One of my favorite philosophers and Christian apologists is a guy named William Lane Craig, who has explored this argument for the existence of God more brilliantly and thoroughly than almost anybody I know.
Okay, well, let's see what William Lane Craig has to say about how robust the evidence for Christianity is.
I thought to myself, and I'm not kidding, I thought, if there is just one chance in a million that this is true, it's worth believing. And so my attitude toward this is just the opposite of Kyle's. Far from raising the bar or the epistemic standard that Christianity must meet to be believed, I lower it.
Well, if the guy who has explored this argument more brilliantly and thoroughly than anyone you know had to lower the epistemic bar for Christianity in order to believe it, that doesn't leave me with very much confidence. And if you followed the William Lane Craig lowering the bar saga, you might have heard him distinguishing between pragmatic justification and epistemic justification as a way of backpedaling what he said there. Pragmatic justification just essentially being a question of, is it practical to believe this thing, whether it is supported by evidence or not? While epistemic justification would be believing something based on evidence that supports it. He says that he was only talking about pragmatic justification in that instance, but that he feels that there is sufficient epistemic justification to warrant Christian belief in spite of that. Fine, I'll accept that. He was essentially just talking about Pascal's wager, which is an argument that is entirely based on pragmatic justification, so that does make a certain amount of sense. The problem is that we don't know how he would have approached the epistemic justification for the belief in Christianity if he didn't begin with his bias, which started at a pragmatic justification with a low epistemic bar. I think it was put best in Paula Gia's coverage on the topic, so let's just give that a quick listen.
So I am perfectly fine with making our decision to believe purely on epistemic grounds.
But the trouble, Dr. Craig, is that you didn't make your decision to believe on epistemic grounds.
The fundamental ground-level way in which I know my faith is true is through this inner self-authenticating witness of God's Spirit, which assures me that I am a child of God.
We will never have a chance to know how compelling you would find all the arguments you list without the bias from your pre-existing assurance you attribute to the Holy Spirit.
I'd highly recommend watching Paul's whole video on that if this is a topic that interests you, so I'll leave a card for that for you. My main point in bringing this up is just to be careful who you cite as an authority on stuff like this. You're making it sound like this is going to be based on the most rigorous examination of the evidence possible. Meanwhile, the guy you're citing admits to starting all his investigations with the conclusion that he is right about God's existence first, and so he is incapable of coming to any other conclusion, regardless of what the evidence might be.
The first premise is that if something begins to exist, it must have a cause for its existence.
And the first premise is wrong. Causality is wonky, especially when we get down to the quantum level. In quantum physics, if you have a situation where A causes B, it is possible for the direction of causality to flow both ways simultaneously. That is, A causes B, but at the same time, B causes A. This is counterintuitive as fuck, but that's par for the course for quantum mechanics. So if something begins to exist, it must have a cause for its existence. But since the origin of the universe would have happened at the quantum scale, we are now left with the possibility that the universe beginning to exist caused the cause that caused the existence of the universe while simultaneously being caused by that cause. As to the beginning to exist part of this premise, in the past I have brought up virtual particles as potentially being an example of something that begins to exist in the sense that this argument actually requires, but after reading up on them a bit more, I'm not convinced that I was right about that. So I'm going to not talk about them anymore because it seems that the more I learn about them, the less I actually understand them. But this does bring us to the next problem in the first premise, the fact that it's a composition fallacy. Everything that makes up the universe behaves in this way, therefore the whole universe must also behave in this way. This is the equivalent of the bottom-of-the-barrel apologist that I sometimes am given grief for even covering, saying things like, how can consciousness exist from just a collection of unconscious cells? Just because a part of something has a property does not mean that when you take the whole thing together as a single unit, that that unit will have the same property. Or in the case of the consciousness from the cells thing, lacks that property. But this now brings us to the second premise.
The second point is that the universe began to exist. That means the universe has a beginning.
Now, setting aside that the consensus among cosmologists is that it did not have the kind of beginning necessary to make this argument work, this premise has us equivocating. Equivocating is when you change how you're using a word in a way that creates ambiguity. Taking it out of the realm of logical argumentation, it's also a common joke format. My dog has no nose. Well, how does he smell? Terrible. That joke equivocates on the word smell, using it as a verb, to smell, in one place, and using it as a noun, a scent that the dog has, in another. Well, in the cosmological argument, premise one uses begins to exist in the sense of things that we are familiar with. Often examples are used of babies. Babies begin to exist, but they have a cause, a fertilized egg. Well, as the apologist will often point out while making the argument, babies don't just pop into existence out of nothing. They are a rearrangement of previously existing matter and energy. But by the time we get to premise two, the apologists will usually have already established that they think the universe somehow came into existence out of nothing, not that it was a rearrangement of previously existing material. And so the phrase begins to exist in premise two doesn't mean the same thing that it does in premise one. I would argue that it's actually impossible for us to know whether or not a universe could begin to exist in this sense without a god's intervention, based purely on the fact that we have zero data points from which to make any inferences about the possibility of a universe as coming from nothing. That's even worse than the typical one data point that things like the fine-tuning argument rely on. It is pure speculation based on nothing more than intuition.
And then the final point, what William Lane Craig says, is that if those first two points are true, then point number three, therefore the universe has a cause for its existence.
And really, this shows just how weak this argument is. Because even given all of the logical fallacies and unwarranted assumptions that managed to get packed into the first two premises, if we ignore that and pretend that this argument works perfectly, then we're still left with the rather unimpressive, therefore the universe had a cause for its existence. I don't know of anyone who denies that the universe had a cause. I certainly don't. So why apologists feel the need to jump through all these really sketchy logical hoops just to get us to a conclusion that we would have already agreed with in the first place is quite baffling to me.
As a matter of fact, the reason why I read that verse to you from Genesis is because that was believed to be written, I believe, about 3,400 years ago. So about 3,400 years ago, the biblical author claimed that the universe had a beginning. And what's crazy is that it wasn't until the last like 100 years or so that science confirmed what the Bible claimed thousands of years ago.
Yeah, that's a bit of a stretch, is it not? I mean, there are at least 9 ancient cultures that had creation myths where the deity did the creating out of nothing, giving a beginning to the universe. If you have a story about God creating everything, you essentially have two choices. Either they did it out of something that already existed, or they did it out of nothing. the fact that a number of ancient cultures went for the nothing option, while a bunch of other ones went for the something option, is completely unsurprising.
So the question becomes, if everything that begins to exist has a cause, and the universe began to exist, therefore the universe must have a cause, what is that cause?
Exactly. That is indeed the question. I know of no one who denies that the universe had a cause. The whole argument up to this point is an entirely superfluous word salad meant to give an air of intellectualism to what is, at the end of the day, a very basic question.
We can conclude, right, that the universe, which consists of all of space, time, and matter, right? Like, all of space, time, and matter is a part of the universe.
Not necessarily. There are several cosmological models that have time and energy, which for the purposes of this discussion, matter is basically frozen energy, so when he says matter, just mentally replace it with energy. But at the very least, time and energy can exist outside the universe, and maybe space too. I'm not exactly an expert on the matter after all. But my point is that most cosmologists agree that something predates the universe, and even in the cosmologies where it doesn't, you wind up with things like the Hartle-Hawking model, where space-time breaks down when you take it back to the Big Bang, so you wind up with a beginning state in which space exists but not time, and so asking what existed before the origin of the universe just becomes a nonsensical question. Time began 13.7 billion years ago, there was no time before that, and space and energy have existed for at least as long as time has. My point is, this line of argumentation relies on a degree of knowledge of the origin of the cosmos that it's just not possible to have at the moment. So since the scientific answer can be summarized as, we don't know for sure, apologists like to stick God in there as the answer.
So that means whatever caused the universe to begin has to be spaceless, timeless, and immaterial.
And what do you call something when it doesn't exist in space or time and isn't made of matter or energy? Personally, I call that non-existent. Of course, that's just a pithy quip that isn't really a great counter to this argument, but it's still amusing to say.
So it has to be, spaceless. So it has to be infinite, timeless, it has to be eternal, immaterial. It's not going to be something physical.
Those things are not synonymous. Something spaceless is not automatically infinite, nor is something timeless necessarily eternal. You did get one right, though. Immaterial does pretty much exactly mean not physical. But again, these are just assumptions about the cause of the universe. They usually aren't backed up with anything, and in the rare cases when they are, it's not in the way that would be needed to point to a god. Like the aforementioned Hartle-Hawking model. It could be said that whatever existed before time began, inasmuch as that is even a coherent statement, was timeless, but not in the sense that apologists mean when they claim that God is timeless. But then we could also look at something like the Carol Chen model, where the quality of timelessness isn't even a requirement for something to be eternal. In this model, there was a point in the history of the cosmos where entropy reversed. Since we perceive the passage of time as a function of entropy, in the past when entropy reversed, we end up with a cosmos that looks like it has always existed, with time extending infinitely out in both directions, but with the entropy reversal point looking like the beginning. My point is that the study of cosmology never actually gets you to a point where the scientific research would support the cosmological argument, so it'd be really nice if apologists would stop claiming that it does.
The best way that I've heard it described is it has to be some type of spirit.
And what does that even mean? What exactly is a spirit? I know you want us to assume that the spirit has to be the Christian God, and this is just another step along the way there, but before we can say that a spirit is needed to accomplish this, we first have to figure out what a spirit even is, what properties it has, how these properties are or are not indicated by what we know of the beginning of the universe, and more. You can't just throw that out there as an assertion without backing it up.
Also, it's got to be really, really powerful to create everything we know in the universe.
And in this context, what do you mean by powerful? Do you mean has enough energy to have created the universe? Because I've got news for you. If it was just pure energy that existed prior to the Big Bang, it would have been enough energy to create the universe, pretty much by definition. But then we're also left with the interesting fact that energy has both positive and negative states. And I don't mean like in the cathodes and anodes of an electrical circuit with positive and negative charges. I mean that in the sense that gravity, or rather gravitational fields, are negative energy. It takes an expenditure of positive energy to move two gravitationally attracted objects away from each other, and then once they are separated, they have gravitational potential energy based on their gravitational fields, which is negative. And when we look at the universe and add up all the positive and negative energy, it actually appears to be zero. Since the total energy of the universe appears to be equal to zero, it turns out that, rather counterintuitively, you don't actually need all that much in the way of energy expenditure to create the universe. Actually, you don't need any energy expenditure to create the universe. To quote Alan Guth from his 1997 book on the topic, after 2,000 years of scientific research, it now seems likely that Lucretius was wrong. Conceivably, everything can be created from nothing, and everything might include a lot more than what we can see. In the context of inflationary cosmology, it is fair to say that the universe is the ultimate free lunch. And for context, Lucretius was the Roman philosopher who first said nothing can be created from nothing.
So what is it that we call this thing that is spaceless, timeless, immaterial, and immensely powerful? Well, as Christians, we call that thing God.
Yeah, call it whatever you like, but it's not indicated by the data at this time.
What's really interesting is that for literally thousands of years, atheist scientists held on to the belief that the universe was eternal because they knew that if the universe had a beginning, that would be evidence for the universe having a beginner.
Actually, what's most interesting about that statement is that it's just flat out not true. For the majority of history, being an atheist was pretty much unacceptable. And because of this, you can often find apologists claiming that science supports the existence of God, because historically, most scientists have believed in God. But notably, the discoveries that led to our current understanding of cosmology were made by scientists who ran the gamut of religious belief, from the obsession of occultism that Isaac Newton had, to the deism of Einstein, to the hard-to-pin-down-what-he-even-believes-about-God of Guth, to the Catholic Lemaître, to the atheism of Fred Hoyle. Looking at history, it's actually much harder to find someone who called themselves an atheist and who studied the origin of the universe than it is to find the religious ones who studied the origin of the universe. And even in modern times, most cosmologists seem reluctant to outright deny a belief in God, instead just leaving the belief in God as a data point that is, and should be, irrelevant to their work. But with the claim you just made, it does become relevant. If historically most scientists who worked on the origins of the universe believed in God, then why did the steady state model of the universe persist as long as it did? Shouldn't one of those previous scientists have figured out to posit that in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth? Now, sure, Fred Hoyle, who was most well known for opposing the Big Bang Theory, did call himself an atheist, but he also went on record as stating that he believed a super intellect monkeyed with physics in order to explain the origin of life, even going so far as to be the first person known to have used the tornado in a junkyard argument for the origin of life that is favored by creationists today. Okay, I thought I'd be able to skip more of this than I ended up doing, so I'm gonna split this one up into probably three parts, assuming part two is similarly non-skippable. So that's it for this one. Today's comment of the day comes to us from Angel Plays, who says, "All of this guy's videos are about disproving Christianity as if it were some sort of science instead of belief. He doesn't seem to attack other religions that have some inconsistencies of their own, and each of his videos comes with an FBI copyright warning." Well, Angel, first, most of my videos will fall into one of two categories. Either they will be examining the scientific claims that are made by religious organizations like Answers in Genesis, where I usually end up pointing out that when they talk about science, they get it all wrong. Occasionally they get something right, and I do like to point out those rare instances, but they are very infrequent, so it doesn't happen often. The other category will be looking at logical argumentation for the existence of God, where I look at the arguments being made, and if I find flaws in the arguments, I point out those flaws. Now, a number of my videos actually fall into both categories. This video, for instance, mostly dealt with the cosmological argument, which is a logical argument for God, but because apologists like to try and give it a veneer of scientific plausibility, they try to tie it to science by claiming that its premises are scientifically supported, which they are not. And I mostly focus on Christianity for one simple reason. I used to be a Christian, so I have a much greater understanding of Christianity than I do of, say, Buddhism. So this makes me much less likely to end up being completely wrong about something basic about the religion. As to the copyright warning, if you actually take a moment to read it, you'll see that it's actually a fair use warning. The videos I respond to are protected by copyright, because any creative endeavor is automatically protected. However, you are allowed to use copyrighted material without permission under certain circumstances, one of which is commentary or critique. The warning doesn't really do anything, it's more of a just-in-case thing, so if somebody sues me for copyright infringement, it serves as evidence that my intention was to provide commentary and critique as stipulated by the fair use exception. I'm unsure of how this would or would not hold up in court, and I hope to never have to find out, but I am not the first person to use such a warning, nor am I the last. So it's kind of a everybody else is doing it, so maybe it's a best practice thing. Thanks for watching. Thanks to Tim Robertson for being my Patreon manager, and special thanks as always to my patrons, who are the positive energy that counterbalances the negative energy of my channel. If you'd like to call me fat based on the fact that more mass equals more negative energy, you can join us on Patreon for as little as a dollar per week over at patreon.com/vicerhino, or by supporting the channel in one of the other methods that can be found at links.vicerhino.com, which is also where you'll find links to my other projects. If for whatever reason you want to send me stuff, my P.O. Box address is in the description. See you next time!